This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're taking a bit of a step back from the moment-to-moment news, and instead, we're going to focus on the history of pandemics. The coronavirus itself is a novel or new virus, and a lot of the changes we've made to daily life are new to us as well. But pandemics themselves aren't new. Humanity has survived countless plagues, but that doesn't mean that we haven't been changed by them. How does today's crisis compare, and how will we be changed? If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now is Professor Emerita of History at Indiana University, Ann Carmichael. Ann, great to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. This is an honor. Thank you.
And we also welcome an associate professor of philosophy at Ball State University, Kevin Harrelson. Kevin, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, Matt.
Ann, you've spent your career studying the history of medicine, public health, and epidemiology. When do we see the earliest historical evidence of a pandemic?
I'm not even sure that you see that directly from the records, but we think so now. The Justinianic plague at the end of classical antiquity. It's in the 500s. And there are enough scattered reports, it was subsequently recognized as a pandemic involving many different places. But I think that that sense of the whole world involved, that, you know, remember the World Health Organization was waiting for that moment when they would say, OK, everybody's in this one with COVID. That was with the Black Death in 1347, 1348. I mean, the immediate thing that pops to mind is the great father of humanism, Francesco Petrarch, or Petrarca, and he says it's not, you know, not one place or another, but the entire world. So that sense of everybody being in it, I think dates from that point. Recently, there are lots of biomedical, archaeological, genetic tools to cast a very different history that we can reconstruct about when and when the world is not all involved in the same disease problem. So,
and of course, I mean, it's a lot easier for people to travel now, and that, of course, helps diseases spread. What kind of conditions historically have needed to exist for those pandemics to take off?
Well, in the case of the Black Death, and I think that this is something we have only known really with relative certainty in the last 10 years, it really is modern bubonic plague. And so it has to spread by fleas on rodents or a few other host species. So in a way, it's a bit of a red herring that we follow humans as a way to understand how the disease spread. Most Black Death histories talk about the moving along the Silk Road or in ships across the Mediterranean, all those kinds of things, and they weren't unimportant. But it's also likely that fleas went to a new host and it spread silently and unseen for a very long time and out of the way of where humans were actively transporting grain, rodents, fleas, themselves, their fur capes, that sort of thing. So,
it's spread more slowly at the time because of obviously technology and also our lack of knowledge. And so because it spread more slowly, it lasted longer than perhaps today's pandemic will.
Did it spread more slowly? History is always built around what humans in fact perceive and then leave us a record of. So we have a fairly, our window on this is when humans become involved with this disease, when and where, and they have to possess the ability to write. So there are kind of a lot of unknowns that I think we have to re-examine now that we're pretty sure, well, now that we are sure that the Black Death was caused by a particular rodent microorganism. But so I'm not, I'm being, I guess, too academic about this. The other things on your big list are all spread human to human and very much depend on the state of interpersonal communications. I also, I guess, you know, want to briefly speak to your claim that we're going to burn our way through and, you know, get to the other side of COVID-19. And I think that the quite frightening thing is that we're not absolutely sure of that, at least how I'm reading, you know, what I can understand of this scientific literature.
Sure.
So.
Kevin, you're one of several professors at Ball State that'll be teaching a COVID-19 related course in the upcoming summer months. It's clear that this is a moment that's going to find its way into the history books. But can you talk a little bit about the approach that you're bringing to a topic that's unfolding in real time? What are you hoping to explore?
Well, so thank you for that, Matt. Actually, Ball State is offering 5 different courses on COVID this summer in 5 different colleges. But my course is called COVID-19 in the Human Context. So I'm getting students to think about the human reaction to it. So the first thing that we want to look at is the historical context. You know, from the beginning of the spread of COVID, there have been comparisons to the 1918 flu, in some cases even to medieval plague. So we always have this historical comparison that flies in the face of our sense that this is novel. I mean, we are undergoing something novel in terms, first of all, of the virus. It's not a particular virus that we've encountered before. And second of all, we're having a novel experience insofar as we didn't think that this was possible for us, that we thought plague and epidemics were things of the past. But when we take a deeper look at history, we see that plagues and epidemics are everywhere in the past. So really what we're undergoing is closer to the norm of the human experience than maybe where we were just 6 months ago or 8 months ago. So that's the first thing we want to look at. The second thing we want to look at is the role of science in the public discussion. I mean, I've been astounded at the extent to which scientists are interfacing with the general public. I've watched epidemiologists amass large Twitter followings. And as a matter of fact, I got deep into the study really through some questions that struck up in my mind by following epidemiologists on Twitter. But it raises the whole question of whom do we citizens trust? Who do we get our information from? Whom do we listen to? So I want to raise the question about trust and expertise. We want to bring to light the political divides. So just to tell you a quick story here, I started following these epidemiologists on Twitter, and the first debate that they were having was whether the proper comparison point for the novel coronavirus was the 1918 flu or the 1957 flu. So this sounds like a technical question for epidemiologists, and at that moment, that's exactly how I looked at it. So I'm reading about the 1918 flu, I'm reading about the 1957 flu, and I'm thinking about what these epidemiologists are saying. Suddenly, this whole argument becomes politicized. So it was the Stanford epidemiologists who were pushing the comparison to 1957, which is a less significant, in epidemiological terms, a less significant outbreak, whereas it was the Harvard group who were pushing the comparison to 1918, which is a more significant influenza outbreak. Then the Stanford group published this study called the Santa Clara Serology Study. And the Santa Clara Serology Study concludes that the rate of infection of COVID-19 is actually 50 to 85 times greater than the reported count. If that's true, then 45 or 50 million Americans have already been infected by COVID-19. And if that's true, we should, you know, maybe we've overreacted a little bit. It turns out that this study is being cited by publications, you know, conservative publications that are trying to make an argument for lesser government intervention, whereas the more liberal publications are citing the Harvard epidemiologists. So what strikes me in all this is that the approach that we take to science is mediated by political affiliation. So we live in a world in which the information that comes across our desks is already heavily politicized. And we're in a situation where a certain type of scientific outlook is imperative, and yet we find ourselves maybe unable to approach this information without a certain political lens. So that's one of the big things I want to look at. How does science interface with the public? How does science interface with politics? What is it that drives our political decision making? A third thing that I want to take a look at is the labor conditions. Right now, I'm sitting in my bedroom on a Skype call doing some type of remote work, which is relevant to my job because I have a professional position that's enabled me to continue to be paid, to continue to study, to continue to do the work of a professor under these circumstances. While somebody's outside delivering mail, the grocery store is still operating. And this is because we've divided the world into essential and unessential labor. Now, essential and unessential labor are extant legal categories, right? This is already in the American legal system. And essential labor actually has certain limitations. So, for instance, essential laborers are not allowed to strike, or at least not allowed to strike under the same conditions. Well, will this crisis lead us maybe to rethink about these categories? So who are the essential laborers? The essential laborers are grocery store clerks, factory workers, medical service people, people in the service industry, farmers. Generally speaking, these are people with inferior working conditions, with lesser pay, maybe without guaranteed health care, whereas it's the non-essential workers, in many cases, as in mine, who are in professional positions, who are able to leave the workplace, at least in the short term, and even continue to draw salaries. So I want to think about what's the big picture. How do we understand our society? Can something like this, when our society stops working in the short term, can something like this lead us to, you know, rethink its basic structure? Can lead us maybe to, you know, place a different value on labor or on different types of labor. So those are just a few of the bigger questions that I'm trying to pursue.
We're talking with Kevin Harrelson, an associate professor of philosophy at Ball State University, and Anne Carmichael, professor emerita of history at Indiana University. And we're talking today about the history of pandemics. They'll be sticking around for the rest of the hour with us. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and send your questions or comments, and we'll fit them into today's conversation. I am Matt Pelser, and we're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the history of pandemics. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We are live today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, to 866-476-3881. Joining us via Skype today are Anne Carmichael, professor emerita of history at Indiana University, and Kevin Harrelson, associate professor of philosophy at Ball State University. And we've mentioned the Black Plague, the Black Death, a couple of times already, and we know that we probably won't be able to squeeze the entire comprehensive history of pandemics into our show, but there are those moments that we want to cover. The plague of the 14th century, can you help us wrap our minds around the level of devastation that this plague left in its wake?
Well, I think generally the estimates are a third to maybe 40% of everyone across Eurasia. And recent research has shown that's more involvement in North Africa and maybe even East Africa than we understood before. So it was profound, but it stretched across quite a few years. And because of the state of communication, people didn't necessarily know. One little story that I really liked from some recent research was someone who followed up on people who survived and went to Rome in order to gain forgiveness of their sins. They had vowed a pilgrimage, and that's when they learn about the devastation wasn't just in the place they came from, but everywhere. So that sense was not clear unless you were traveling around. It was huge. They reacted immediately, as we were prescribed to do, with social distancing, and unfortunately, we know this better, the scapegoating. But some of the things that Kevin raised are really quite interesting. Plague just kept coming back, but it was discontinuous. So you might see it if you survived to your 30s or 40s or even longer. You might see it twice in a lifetime, but you had to reinvent how you were going to approach this particular threat over time. And in a largely illiterate society, really only the top 5% could read and write as a best estimate, and those were more often city people. So,
and we talked a little bit in the last segment about how it spread across physical barriers like oceans and seas, and how some of the hosts were carriers like rodents and the fleas that they that lived upon them. But how else did it spread from person to person once it made its way into a community?
Well, I think is that we're rethinking everything that we thought we knew. There are a fair number of people who believe that the bubonic plague became pneumonic, became an airborne droplet. Born infection that was really almost not survivable. We don't have, unfortunately, the clear evidence from the Black Death era. So a lot of newer work is looking at places where we do have more information to work with. Bills of mortality of various sorts, death lists, that sort of thing, so that we can get a sense. The Black Death was not the only really huge epidemic. The 1630 epidemic, at least for a good part of Western Eurasia, was a significant epidemic. None of this, by the way, is at the catastrophic level of Native American losses with the viral diseases that came with Eurasian colonizers and Africans enforced migration to the Western Hemisphere. And there you're looking at over 70% dead within a few years, usually because they're one or more epidemics chasing one another with which they have no experience. So,
what were the symptoms of the Black Plague, the bubonic plague?
Well, here again, the evidence that we have from 1348 is less good and less faithful, and that, of course, opens the door to a lot of historical and biomedical debate. But the classic symptoms were that you fell sick. They didn't know that at the point at which you fell sick, you'd been incubating the disease for 5 days or so. But then you started with a fever, as is common, and for some people, a soreness in a few discrete locations on the body, under the arms, in the groin, behind the ears, in the neck, and these could create great swellings that were extraordinarily painful. So they would call surgeons to lance them. Surgeons were at high risk to this infection. Pneumonic plague, Petrarch again said best, you can be well in the morning at breakfast. He didn't say breakfast, but sup with your ancestors by nightfall, that you were overwhelmingly felled. And then there's this third one classically with plague called septicemic, which only really means that the organism is circulating in the bloodstream. And it's not clear that that's a separate type. So later on, you will get really clear differentiations in medical debates, you know, 1500s, 1600s, about which particular features of illness and suffering are the ones that are true plague as opposed to other kinds of things. And then that's, you know, it's really only the last 400 years that medical science has pushed in the direction of differentiating one kind of clinical death from another as things, diseases, as discrete entities, as opposed to dis-ease or unwellness.
We're talking about the history of pandemics today, and we're on the line with Professor Emerita of History at Indiana University, Ann Carmichael. We're also joined by Associate Professor of Philosophy at Ball State University, Kevin Harrelson. Kevin, I want to jump now to one of the most devastating pandemics in recent history, the Spanish flu of 1918. This pandemic came on toward the end of the First World War. Can you talk about how the death toll compares to both world wars?
Well, I mean, first of all, this is a matter of great dispute because we don't know how many people died in the Second World War. If you study that subject, you'll find various estimates as to how many Russians died in the Second World War in Hitler's campaign in the Soviet Union. If you take a lower estimate of that, it would turn out that at about 50 million people, more people died of the Spanish flu than of both world wars together. However, the two world wars, of course, are the basic items around which we structure our perceptions of the 20th century, maybe together with what we call the Cold War. Whereas the 1918 flu, the so-called Spanish flu, is something that, you know, you can get a high school education or a college education these days and not know a thing about. A recent book, for instance, refers to it as the forgotten pandemic. And this is the thing that struck me when I started seeing the comparisons between COVID and 1918, was that this is an event that killed more people, perhaps, than the two world wars together. And yet it's not a thing that we know much about in the 20th century, that most of us know much about.
I wonder why. Do we have any explanation as to why this isn't something that is remembered or taught in the same way that the world wars are?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of differing theories about this. So first of all, I mean, there are questions of narrative and questions of agency, and these two are tightly bound together. So let's start with narrative. A disease epidemic doesn't come prepackaged in an intelligible narrative. It doesn't have a clear beginning. It doesn't have a clear middle, a turning point, nor does it have a clear end. Notice when you asked Professor Carmichael, who's written a book about the plague, well, when did it begin? When did it end? Right? And she's like, well, it started, it came back. It started, it came back. We've never been able to identify precisely the beginning. And we can't always identify the end, right? And the same is true of the 1918 flu. And as Professor Carmichael, as Anne said here earlier, the same might be true of COVID-19. We name diseases over the places we believe them to have begun, but then we often change our minds about that. You know, did it really begin in Wuhan province? Probably, but you know, opinion about that might change. When will it end? I think Anne made a great point a few minutes ago when she said, let's not presume that we're coming out of the other side of this, you know, at some point in the fall or the spring. Do we know that this won't recur? So in any case, here's the problem of narrative. It's we don't have a clear story about a disease epidemic. What we have are very many people killed over a large swath of time without being able to track in all instances how it took place. The second is the question of agency. In a war, not only do we have a beginning, a turning point, and an end, but we have a hero and a villain. You know, in the Second World War, of course, we have the character of Adolf Hitler, which is possibly why the Second World War looms larger in our memory than the First World War does. But in any case, we have villains. We have heroes. We have agents. We know who begun them. We have treaties that were signed. Whereas the history of disease isn't really the history of human agency. This is another point that Anne nudged us towards in the last segment. She said, when you're thinking about the history of plague, don't track the human movement, because the plague was transported by fleas, by rodents. So this makes it into a harder thing for us to understand, because we're obsessed with human actions. We want to know who did what. History is the study of the past of humanity, or at least history is typically taken to be the study of the past of humanity, whereas the study of disease is the study of a viral organism, a bacterium, in the case of plague. So, you know, that's one set of thinking. Another thing to consider about the 1918 flu outbreak is that even among those who lived through it, the outbreak was overshadowed in their imaginations by the war. Wilson, remember, called the First World War the war to end all wars. The writers who came of age in American literature in the 1920s all wrote about their experiences with the war. They had characters who had suffered from the flu, but they didn't write about the flu as such, right? So the flu did not live on in the imaginations even of the people who experienced it in the way that a lot of other disease pandemics do. I'll make one final point. Think of a counterpoint to the 1918 flu, the Black Death. The Black Death possibly looms larger in our imagination than does, for instance, the Hundred Years' War. Perhaps Anne could correct me on that point. But I think you can make a reasonable case for that, whereas you can't make a reasonable case about the 1918 flu. It really is a forgotten event, and possibly it's an event that we forgot to our own peril.
And why was this pandemic called the Spanish flu?
Well, in fact, and I also thank you, Kevin, for your shout outs. I also have this long list of points that he organized the material differently for me, which is really quite lovely. Nice seminar for the two of us. With the Spanish flu, I mean, the name itself is a reminder that having influenza was a military secret. So that all of the warring parties were suppressing any information. The American public, for example, there are just so many good books in the last 20 years about this, were really blindsided and on their own having to decide what it was they would do. They were also, at least in Europe, grateful for the end of the war, so that there's a sense of going on, the same sense that you get with people after the Black Death. And Boccaccio was, you know, disturbed that so many people are, you know, everywhere you look, women are pregnant, and they're not just having single babies, they're having twins and triplets, and that there's a kind of, you know, repairing the world kind of sense. We call it the Roaring Twenties like thing. But the with the Spanish flu, I'm reminded of the letters of my grandfather, who had just graduated medical school, and he was sent to France in late August of 1918 in a very quickly built hospital complex in central France. He was staffing one of the pneumonia wards. And he wrote home to his father, who was a physician in Southwest Virginia, trying to describe what he was seeing about his patients dying. It's really interesting. I don't know how much he actually wrote, because those letters are all censored. So that there was an enforced silencing about this epidemic, and this sense of, you know, optimism about medical science was kind of brought to a screeching halt as well. So it's a really interesting pandemic. And finally, I just say one thing about it. This is the epidemic that brings the mask into association with epidemic times. The face of the mask, even though it is actually brought into service with a plague in Manchuria in 1910-1911 by a brilliant Chinese Chinese physician. The influenza 1918 is the first one where we see that commonplace image on streets. I'll stop there.
What made the flu of 1918 so deadly? Why was it so different from the seasonal flu we see now?
I was thinking about what, you gave me a list of all of these epidemics. What do I see in common is how the population at large perceives, are they or are they not at risk? And what I think was clear, and we know this, biomedically about 1918, is that there was a segment of the population that was much more likely to die, and they were the 15 to 40-year-olds. Why that was so was because they'd seen neither part of the H1N1 before. They were not previously immunized. They had no partial immunity. But people like my grandfather, who was in that age group, came from rural America, where the old pandemic before in 1889 to 1891, it was still circulating. So he actually ended up having some partial immunity. The second reason that age group was targeted so badly is one that we're talking about with coronavirus, which is the immune overreaction, a cytokine storm. It was seen is that the immune system is trying to overcome the infection, and in fact, just turning the lungs dark blue.
There's a lot more to talk about. We've been speaking with Ann Carmichael, Professor Emerita of History at Indiana University, and Kevin Harrelson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Ball State. Up next, we're going to hear from the Indiana Historical Society about an initiative to document and preserve the history of COVID-19. We're back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the history of pandemics. And as always, we would love your thoughts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. We've been speaking with Ann Carmichael, Professor Emerita of History at Indiana University, and Kevin Harrelson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Ball State University, about what we know about past pandemics. And joining us now to talk about an initiative to ensure that this current moment is preserved in the history books is Jody Blankenship, the President and CEO of the Indiana Historical Society. Jody, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jody, can you introduce us to the initiative at the Indiana Historical Society right now to preserve the history of this moment?
Yes. So we are calling it Documenting COVID-19 in Indiana, and we are asking people throughout the state to contribute their experience and their stories about living through this pandemic as it occurs. So this is everybody in the state, not just politicians or business leaders, but the folks who are on the front lines in grocery stores, letter carriers and delivery people, folks who are quarantined at home, whether they are forced to work from home in their jobs or if they've been let go because of the pandemic. We want to hear everybody's story. And you can contribute it by going to our website, indianahistory.org. You'll see a link right there on the website, and you can go in and contribute electronically.
How's it going so far?
So far, really well. We have a number of submissions, closing in on 1,000 total, and lots of people from throughout the state are contributing all kinds of really unique examples of things that they have gone through. Some of the stories are nationally significant. We had a couple who had a wedding, and someone at their wedding who was in Boston and contracted the disease came to their wedding party and actually spread it. And unknowingly at that point, these folks went to Hawaii for their honeymoon and came down with COVID-19. They were actually the first people on Hawaii to have contracted the virus and were put into quarantine. So they spent their entire honeymoon in quarantine. There's also stories of a mother who is at home with her children and is looking to occupy time, and they have taken to creating arcade games out of cardboard. So you'll see a skee ball machine that they created, a crane hook. There's all kinds of stuff like this.
Kevin, are there other projects like this out there happening right now to document this moment?
I'm glad you asked, Matt, because I promised a plug for a few of my colleagues at Ball State. two colleagues of mine from Ball State, one from the English department and one from the history department, Pat Collier and Jim Connolly, they've been running for a number of years a project called Everyday Life in Middletown, which is a diary project. Like what Jody is talking about. Prior to the pandemic, of course, it was focused on everyday life, on the mundane existence of people in central Indiana. But they've renewed the project to highlight the experiences of quarantine, to experience the experiences of COVID-19 as they've taken place in central Indiana. And we urge people to sign up as diarists, either for the Indiana Historical Society project or for Everyday Life in Middletown. You can sign up as a diarist on the Ball State website at the Everyday Life in Middletown page of the Ball State website.
And can you talk about why these kinds of records stand as a testament to someone's daily experience during this pandemic and why they're so important?
Well, we historians rely on a lot of this kind of material, and it is just profoundly interesting to hear people talk about their own personal experiences. I mean, we're just that tightly connected, and especially as socially isolated or physically isolated or distanced, we want to know what other people are going through and will the burden of all of these diaries and testimonials be distilled into something that we subsequently want to wrestle with. I mean, I think Kevin early on pointed to the problem that we're not quite yet confronting how plagues are the essential laborers and how we actually treat them as a society, whether we will want to try as best we can to snap back to where we were before, to remember our former lives and former selves, or whether we will, in fact, come through this with those memories being channeled in some other way. I'm a kind of cynic from my reading of plagues in the past that we will marshal all of our energy to prevent changing the way we go about the day-to-day.
And I'm curious if today's pandemic is causing historians like yourself to revisit or reevaluate records that we do have from previous pandemics as well.
Absolutely. I think for decades, historians, you know, wanted this faithful attention to the past as it was lived, as they experienced, without the overlay of medicine and biology and things that they could not have known of. But I think we're coming to terms with the skewed history. History is always written for those who are its immediate consumers, that we need basically to learn from COVID to reinterrogate what we have, you know, what remains of the past, to see if the story, you know, how much it's about us, how much it's about how humans are changing the face of the earth. You know, that we've still got another big crisis with global warming sitting there on the other side. It's not going to go away. So I think that those are really interesting. So there even have been essays, seeking historians trying to learn from COVID rather than provide lessons from the past. Past lessons don't often work.
We're talking to Ann Carmichael, Professor Emerita of History at Indiana University. We're also on with Kevin Harrelson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Ball State University, and Jody Blankenship, President and CEO of the Indiana Historical Society. Jody, what kinds of reliable records or maybe even holes in the knowledge does Indiana Historical Society have on how pandemics have affected the state before?
That's a great question. We have over 8 million items in our collection. And so these stories span before statehood for Indiana. And we do have records relating to the 1918 Spanish flu, the 1957 Asian flu, and even more recent things around H1N1 and other things. So there are a lot of records available. The thing I think that is so interesting about what's going on now is oftentimes places like the Indiana Historical Society are looking back to collect. We identify those holes and we try to fill them in, but we're doing so decades, sometimes a century after the event occurred. And what often is so difficult about that is those everyday stories are not often available because there are people, whether they work in a grocery store or they're a letter carrier or an archivist or a historian, who may not save their own stories because they think, well, that's not history. It's just my story. And in fact, those are the such critical records to save and often the hardest to find. So being able to collect in the moment and to make sure that we have those stories really saves us a lot of time in the future going back and trying to fill those gaps, but also creates a phenomenal record that future historians will rely on. I'm often telling my colleagues and friends, you know, history isn't so much about the past. It's more about the future in the sense that we use all this collected information to understand where we are now. I personally love the Mark Twain quote, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. And we're able to take a look at those records, that data that we have, because we can't look into the future and tell the future, we can look back on that past record and begin to piece together what had happened. What were the decisions made? Did they turn out well? Did they cause more problems? And again, compare that to what we're dealing with now. The context may be different. Some of the there's certainly an awful lot of data that we can make use of. And it's all in this record at the Indiana Historical Society and throughout the state, local historical societies.
Kevin, we've been talking about preserving personal experience, but how does the amount of sheer data, oftentimes data that's available to us in real time, compare to pandemics of the past?
It's an interesting question, Matt. Just the other day, I was reading a book by Daniel Defoe called A Journal of the Plague Year. This is a book that's written in 1722 about the plague year of 1664 in London, right? So it's written about 58 years after the fact. Defoe begins the book by noting, in that time, we didn't have printed newspapers like we did today, so we didn't get the information so quickly. So just think about that. This is in 1722, when he's looking back just 50 years earlier, to a time when the information wasn't spread so easily. Now we have the opposite problem. We can get information at our fingertips from anywhere in the world. But the problem that we're confronted with is, which information do we trust? What do we pay attention to? I think we're all suffering at the moment from information overload as it pertains to COVID. We all want to understand this virus. We all want to understand the political situation, the economic implications, so that we can make decisions about how we act individually and collectively. But we don't know really where to begin, right? It's so easy to be misled by fake news, by stories taken out of context, by data that's misreported, by political ideologies or ideologically based reporting. We're in a difficult situation. We're in a unique situation historically in terms of the access that we have to scientific information, and also in terms of the literacy. Ann said earlier that, you know, at certain points in the plague, you have a 5% literacy rate. Well, now we have an historically high percent literacy rate, but that doesn't mean that we have the skills for parsing the information. that we need. And that's one of the things that I hope that we educators take out of this pandemic. We need to train students. We need to train the public in how to read information, how to parse the information, how to make sound decisions, how to distinguish the ideological thrust of a piece of reporting from the more reliable pieces of information within it. It's a difficult time and a difficult task.
Jody, along those lines, do you think that the tools we have available to us today will fundamentally change the way we tell the story of COVID-19 in the future? I'm thinking of the media landscape, social media, things like that, where we can all share our collective experience so easily and readily, and that it exists forever in a way.
Yeah, yes, I do. And it's not just the outlets that we have available, but the way we have to connect information together. So new types of search that we have now are able to look at things contextually, semantically, and pull together bits of information that would have been strewn across the landscape at different organizations and geographically different places. And now, because of the tools we have available, we're able to pull together this disparate information in very meaningful ways. That's something we have never had before. But I think the professor here is right. One of the problems we have is ultimately learning how to deal with this information in a very productive way and how to parse out what information is valuable and what isn't. And I think where the discipline of history has a chance to move forward and become a much more relevant discipline, as it's sort of taken a back seat in the last few years to the STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and other things, is to look at the fundamental necessity of learning how to use information effectively. And that is something that historians, archivists, we do all the time. It's not something anymore that is a nice thing to have. It's absolutely fundamental. And I think that we ought to be focusing more at the K-12 level on the discipline of history and what that teaches us in terms of making use of information and creating meaning.
Mm-hmm. And what's also interesting is how much more access we have to each other's lives right now. What we're talking about, social media, it allows for people to see how their friends are living in quarantine, but also how celebrities and public figures are getting along in a way that wasn't possible before. And some have made the argument that this kind of digital connection is only highlighting class differences that exist in the U.S. Any comment on that?
I absolutely am fascinated by this aspect that we can surf into people's private spaces more easily, but we go out into the places where we're used to being and seeing each other, and they're empty, or relatively so. It's really interesting. We're also seeing people kind of think about their own predicament in real time. I love that Kevin mentioned Defoe. I've often thought when I follow my favorite Twitter epidemiologist that I'm a latter day Defoe's narrator who's following the books of the dead, trying to decide what is his best strategy, which parts of London are the most dangerous, what he's most curious about, when he's safe to go out, all of those kinds of things that we're trying to translate. This, some people have called it a fire hose of information into how we navigate our own lives. And it's really interesting to see into other spaces. They can navigate differently because they live differently. And it very much exacerbates the sense that we may not be all in this together, the essential workers thing. It's really hard to miss, particularly when celebrities do this, when celebrities invite you into their homes and
In our last minute or so, Jody, I'm going to break a rule. I'm going to ask a historian to predict the future. We've learned today that plagues and pandemics tend to act to some degree as turning points in history. And when we look back at this pandemic, say, 100 years from now, what changes do you predict we might be able to point to in society?
I really hope, and I emphasize hope, this is a moment of reset for us. I think that tragedies like this give us an opportunity to reexamine our lives and what really matters to us. I think sometimes when things have gone so well for so long, and we've certainly we've had tragedy in the last few years, in the last decades, certainly, but nothing on this scale. And I think it's a chance for us to revisit what values we have, what makes a difference for us, who are those people who really matter in our lives? Is it the celebrities or is it the people stocking shelves in the grocery store? I think this is going to be a chance. I hope this will be a chance for our society to look back and set a reset button and say, who are we? What do we want to be? And how do we go forward from here?
Jody Blankenship is president and CEO of the Indiana Historical Society. Thank you so much for your time and good luck on the project.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to Ann Carmichael, Professor Emerita of History at IU, and Kevin Harrelson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Ball State. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All In.